Okay, hello, hello.
Hey.
It's time for another thrilling episode of the Grace and Paul podcast.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
So, we had a little fun yesterday.
Yeah, we did. I thought so.
my 50th birthday is coming up, and my marvelous wife threw me a surprise party.
Yeah, she did, didn't she?
And I'm... It was fun. I was really happy to see my friends. But let's just say that being dragged out of my shell, my snail shell.
Kicking and screaming the whole way.
And sort of thrust into the light of, it's ultimately good for me, but it's sort of horrifying as it happens.
But what?
But I had a good time, and she knew I would, so.
Yes.
Anyway, I love you, sweetie.
I love you too.
Okay. So we have a special topic. This is sort of a continuation of a conversation we had a while back. I posted a summer rerun where we talked about definitions, defining our terms.
And I want to get back in right back into that. I've got a long page full of definitions and things to talk about. But I did want to just lightly touch on the works of mercy, which I didn't remember well last week.
Oh, yeah, you wrote them down.
So I just wrote them down. And I did, with your help, remember the corporate works of mercy.
Corporal.
Well, the
corporate are like philanthropical organizations and t-shirts and water bottles.
Corporal works of mercy. Feeding the hungry, water the thirsty, clothing the naked, sheltering the homeless, visiting the sick. I want to expand just slightly. Visiting the imprisoned, ransoming captives, and freeing the imprisoned are things that you've seen throughout different parts of church history.
Ransoming captives.
Yes.
Huh, so interesting, yeah.
So, for example, when enslaved people would somehow procure their freedom, mm-hmm. they would then purchase family members out of slavery. They would go get a job. They'd earn some money, save the money.
They'd buy their families out of hock.
Right, they'd buy their families out of.
This is when people were indentured servants.
Oh, and also it all happened all throughout the history of slavery in the United States. Mm-hmm. It was fairly rare, but it happened that, like, you know, a family had a small number of slaves, say, like, I don't know, a dozen or so. And then when dad died, he would, or mom died or someone died, they would emancipate their slaves upon their death. Mm. And then, but like someone's spouse or child had been sold into slavery on another piece of property, they would then, with their freedom, get a job, earn some money, and purchase that family member out of slavery.
Actually, buy them and then like give themselves back to the person.
Exactly.
Give the person back to
the person. But here's the thing, though. Since they purchased them, they would be listed on the census as enslaved.
So that family member
would be the legal owner, and that person would be listed as enslaved on the census.
Yeah, I wonder what that turned into. You're doing the dishes.
We'll not expand on that here.
No.
But throughout different parts of church history, this is how we've understood visiting the imprisoned as ransoming captives and freeing the imprisoned, as in, you know, freeing people who were unjustly imprisoned. And lastly, burying the dead. The one where I was stuck and the one that I work on in my terms of spiritual works of mercy, I focus a lot on prayer, but there are seven of them. Mm-hmm. And depending on where I am and what the situation is, I may or may not be qualified for them. There's instructing the ignorant, counseling the doubtful, admonishing sinners, bearing wrongs patiently. Everyone can do that. Forgiving offenses, comforting the afflicted, and praying for the living and the dead. So those last three, really, all of us can embrace that.
You don't have to be... have any super special knowledge or abilities to take on those ones.
Yeah, like, pardon me, the last four. So bearing wrongs patiently, you can do it. You can forgive offenses. You can do it.
Yep.
And I think formal forgiveness as an absolution is unique, but just being forgiving, no, you
being
can do
being forgiving
it.
To other people.
You can do it. Comforting the afflicted, you can do it. Praying for the living and the dead, you can do it. Yeah, I just wanted to close that loop. I felt... I was frankly embarrassed not to know that.
Not to have them all at hand. Yeah. Well, you know, will this be on the test? So.
Yeah, apparently it is.
Turns out.
All right.
So can you aim yourself so you're a little more head on?
Is that better?
Just like you should be sort of straight onto the mic.
Okay. Is it, I think,
Just move your chair a bit.
Okay. Pardon me.
It's going to make noise.
Well, not that much noise.
All right.
Okay.
So, yeah, you want to be kind of aimed straight at the end of the mic.
Okay.
All right, great.
So, I feel like there's a lot of, I don't know, wishy-washy, willy-nilly, using words however you want whenever you talk about things in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And these words have literal meanings, assumed meanings, popular meanings, but they also have like just basic meaning and their history of what the word means that I think we lose sight of. And we forget what we're even talking about when we get into the conversation. Or actually, it makes it very easy for us to obscure what's really happening by calling things random names.
Mm-hmm.
You know, calling a rose a stink bug for, you know, because everyone calls it a stink bug now. So I want to start with conservatism and liberalism. So just the word conservatism or conservative or to conserve, right? Just that sort of the root.
Yeah.
Of the idea.
Yeah.
The first thing, if you look it up in Merriam-Webster, is that it's about preserving.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually the very first line, and it launches into more conversation about what it is to preserve things. And that's what it is to conserve something, is to preserve it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's secondarily a philosophy of preserving things, preserving the social order, preserving wealth, preserving creation, the created, you know, the existing world, the physical world.
Mm-hmm. Institutions. Families. Yeah.
And there is an element of, since your guiding light is to conserve things,
mm-hmm.
and part of that being the social order, you also end up being in the camp of preserving current injustices.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
That definitely happens.
This is something, I was just reading somebody's comments on Twitter. They were talking about how, I don't want to derail, but being a centrist, if you try to stake out a centrist position, you're open to preserving current hierarchy.
Yes.
At least, you know, and that winds up being effectively the opposite of a progressive position.
Yeah.
Not just slightly opposed to a progressive position.
But the opposite.
Yeah. Anyway, keep going.
And so this is rightfully, I think, a strong criticism of conservatism, is that ultimately you err on the side of preserving injustice rather than upsetting the apple cart.
And we see where a lot of people who call themselves modern conservatives call people who want to do any kind of activism, any kh of change, as SJWs, social justice warriors, as if that's a horrifying thing. Yeah.
And I think, yeah. And conversely, liberalism, in some ways, is the opposite. It's sort of let's try it and see kind of attitude, right? But if you look it up,
the definition
is really the thing we're talking about when we talk about liberalism, is we're talking about the liberal arts and education, and that's really it's the first thing that pops up in the dictionary.
The old definition,
right? We're talking about the liberal arts, the trivium and the quadrivium, where we learn about learn liberally about the world
across different fields, just one narrow field.
You're not learning one narrow field. You're learning from a variety of different fields of the store of human knowledge.
I think traditionally it was, you were not learning only theology, right?
Correct.
Yeah. You were not learning only the Bible.
You were learning the other things we know about, science, math, history.
And at the time, like in the medieval era, these things included astronomy and, right. You know, all stuff.
Alchemy,
right?
And so on.
Yeah.
So
geometry and mathematics.
But thirdly, it implies a generosity, mm-hmm. that, you know, well, adding a little bit more wouldn't hurt. Like my joke about being liberal with butter, right?
Right.
And that's where...
Personally, you're not conservative with butter.
No. No, I'm not.
And bacon fat.
Not at all. So, yeah. You know, and that's a personal position. You may feel differently. I understand.
Yeah.
So
on this important issue.
Yes. but we've come to this place where, in practice, conservatism and liberalism describe a set of policy prescriptions,
mm-hmm.
that aren't necessarily even opposed to each other. They're just different lists.
Not really. I mean, liberalism in the 80s and, you know, from like the time that I really started to become aware of politics in the 80s mm-hmm. and whatnot was the liberal was the person in favor of big government programs.
Right.
And big interventions and a big welfare state.
Right.
Which I embrace personally, but mm-hmm. but that was the, you know, there you go again. That was Ronald Reagan,
there
the tax
again.
And spend,
tax
you
and
know,
spend.
Tax and spend.
Yeah.
And that was liberal for many people growing up and whole generation, I think, was
yeah.
You're a big government.
And you can kind of get person. The idea, kind of, sort of, if you think of generosity, you know, the and bigness,
mm-hmm.
that bigger is better, more is better, and then
yeah.
the government's generous to its populace. You can kind of get sort of a, maybe kind of sort of equation between them.
And there's sort of an aspect, you know, you can talk about cultural liberalism as well.
Right, so. And modern conservatism, though.
Yes.
As a set of policy prescriptions on the other side of that, aren't necessarily the other side of that. It's a little
not
odd.
Really. No, it's things have shifted and changed.
They're largely, like I said, they're just different lists. They aren't things that are, by definition, conservative, as in focused on preserving.
Right.
And they aren't things that are liberal, as in focused on generosity and learning.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Focused
and learning
on,
widely.
You know, like engaging in all these foreign overseas interventions is not preserving much.
It doesn't preserve anything.
You know.
I mean, I suppose it is liberal with our weapons.
We're liberal with our interventions.
With our interventions and weaponry. I guess that's one way to describe it.
Right.
But it's, but no.
And you can't really stake out in that aspect of it, you can't really stake out a gulf between the liberals and the conservatives. Right.
Right? So. It doesn't make sense. I mean, I think if you can convince people who describe themselves as liberal
yeah.
that the intervention is humanitarian, they're all for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And versus if you can convince...
Or in the interest of... important for national security.
Important for national yeah. security. But if you can convince people... That describe themselves as conservative,
mm-hmm.
that this is an issue of safety.
Yeah, safety is their big trigger.
Then you can convince them to for the same intervention,
mm-hmm.
for the same act.
Right.
Right. You can convince right. both groups to go for it, but just you hold up the boogeyman of humanitarianism.
Sure,
you hold up the boogeyman of yeah, of safety.
Yeah, for conservatives, we're convinced about the Iraq War because of weapons of mass destruction
safety.
And. And Democrats were convinced because we've got to, you know, save the he's an evil dictator. We've got to liberate them.
Right. Right. And so here we are doing mm-hmm. this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Doing the same thing for different reasons. And whoa, it's neither liberal nor conservative, except in the grossest sense.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, gross as in perverse, the most perverse sense. So that's I think that is a very tight nutshell. Where we should be talking and thinking in terms of liberalism and conservatism, in terms of conserving and preserving,
uh-huh.
and in terms of learning expansively and generously and openly.
Mm-hmm.
And neither of those are bad things.
No, they shouldn't be.
They shouldn't be bad things. Yeah. It shouldn't be a dirty thing.
Those definitions have, like you say, shifted out from under us a lot.
And I'll say something right now to describe myself. I think of myself as a left-wing conservative anarchist.
Mm-hmm. You just made,
which, you know,
some listeners had just exploded.
Right, which is like, you know, may seem like a word salad, but
right.
those things aren't like just interchangeable or even necessarily in conflict.
They're actually describing different axes,
like, different perspectives
that are orthogonal to each other,
right.
not parallel to each other.
Right.
Yeah.
So, given that, you need to kind of like, and maybe you yourself, listener, or you, Paul, or whomever you are,
I'm your husband.
Oh, that's right. Right. May actually be more something than you ever realized you were.
Yeah.
If you are able to pull these things apart and think about them separately.
Well, this is, one of my favorite podcasters, Dan Carman, does a show called Common Sense.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about having a Martian perspective. And he really does try to get to the bottom of, you know, what are the actual policies and what are the actual thoughts behind these words?
Right.
And he describes himself as, you know, if you really take this apart and come down to, you know, what are you going to advocate for? What do you believe in? You may, like me, discover that you're not a liberal or a conservative. You're a radical. And that's right. The only thoughtful place to be.
To be. Right, yeah. Right. I mean, and I also embrace the term radical.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Do you want to talk about left and right a little bit?
Yeah, actually. Okay. So this is, I think, it's important to understand where the term comes from.
Yeah, definitely.
Because, and this is why I like to think of myself as a radical, it's important for me to get to the root of what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that's what, just if you don't have any Latin or Greek, radical means root.
Yes.
That the root of radical is root.
So, left wing and right wing comes from the way that representatives were seated in the ancient regime in France.
Mm-hmm.
So during the Revolutionary War period, as the ancient regime or the old order was overthrown, this phrase about who you were
mm-hmm.
stuck. In the ancient regime, if you were an aristocrat, you sat on the right side
mm-hmm.
of what was basically Congress, the room. And if you were a commoner, you sat on the left side.
So what that basically turned into is if you were a person, like in the British Parliament equivalent, it would be the House of Lords and House of Commons.
Right.
And that's where you get a lot of, you know, like there's a Billy Bragg song. I don't think it's original to him, but which side are you on? Yeah, side are you on? So are you left being aligned with the commoners, with the people, with the lowborn, the people who didn't come to political authority by birth.
By birth. Or were you aligned with the aristocrats?
Yeah.
And no, I'm pretty clear. It's pretty clear for me.
Yeah.
That I'm aligned with commoners, not with aristocrats.
Yeah. So this is why I call myself on the left or a leftist.
Or a leftist.
And to me, the right, honestly, is not even so much aligned with aristocrats per se, but you were talking about fascism and corporatism, authority. Aligned with corporate interests.
Oh, and authority.
And capital.
Yeah, yeah.
Large. And these days, inconceivably large quantities of capital.
Yeah, and I'm not on the side of capital. I'm on the side of labor. Right. I'm not on the side of the fascists or the authoritarians.
Right.
I'm just not. So I'm a leftist for that reason.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And I was raised to be that. My mother was probably, you would call her a New Deal Democrat, you know.
Oh, yeah. That's how I would describe your mom.
Yeah. And she worked
in the... She was a saint, by the way.
I just was tweeting to someone. She worked on... community mental health center for her whole career as an occupational therapist. So she literally was part of the safety net.
Yeah.
The liberal state, the welfare state safety net for community, offering community mental health services, and helped a lot of people, you know, in her career. So.
So that's where leftist, rightist, and left-wing and right-wing come from.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a personal decision. If you really feel that you're on the side of capital and authority, then maybe you should continue to call yourself a right-winger.
Yeah, yeah.
But a lot of people who style themselves as populists kind of have no business also describing themselves as right-wingers if they are populists.
You better explain populist.
Populist is
it's kind of a populism. Dirty it's kind of a
it's kind
dirty
of a dirty word.
Word.
Yeah, and a lot of people poo-poo it and dismiss it because of what we talk about with democracy. You know, it's a democracy is a system that gave us Barabbas over Jesus. So the
it's populism historically has been very tightly tied to demagogues. Demagoguery.
Right. And if you can swing the mob.
Mm-hmm. The rabble
to follow you, you know, and you can whip them up into a fury.
Rouse the rabble.
Right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, this sort of cult of personality follows that leader, right? And so maybe if you're into that, maybe you are a right winger who wants to follow an authority.
Yeah, that's how I see so many people who are Trump fans, and also so many people who are Hillary fans. In other words, fans of the person.
The person.
Not the policies.
The policies.
They really don't spend their time thinking about the policies and don't have good policy arguments or good doctrine about policy or whatnot, but think so fondly about, well, the identity of the person.
Right.
To me, that tells me that you want to be ruled and that your vision of politics is more like People magazine. You know, it's more like a cult of celebrity.
Right. And that you're following this person.
Yeah.
And this leadership.
Right. And I reject that utterly and always have, that, you know, I don't defer to anyone famous or powerful for being famous or powerful.
Right, right.
You know, and I don't have a lot of patience or respect when people saying, you need to respect the office of the presidency. Yeah.
I guess.
In as much as, you know, the Congress could subpoena me or the president could order me assassinated legally or something like that. I suppose. I have respect for it, but...
Yeah. Like your respect to fire. So you have to figure out where you stand on authority to decide if you're a left wing or right wing.
Yeah.
And maybe if you're... I think populism can swing both left wing and right wing. It can turn into this authoritarian thing where you are rushing in behind this authority figure.
Yes.
And it can also swing left wing, as in, well, we're all here hungry. We got to do something about food first.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're all here homeless. We got to do something about getting everyone shelter first.
Right.
And that's also very populist. All of us need healthcare.
Yeah.
We've got to do something about that first. And that's populist. As in what, not just popular, but what the populace needs.
One of the reasons I think populist is a derogatory or an insult is because all established political systems are afraid of it.
Are afraid of it, absolutely terrified of it. Well, and how could they not be? Because all established political systems... defer to an elite, defer to a small elite,
mm-hmm.
either an individual or a family or a small group of individuals. And so...
And this was baked into our system,
yeah.
on our country and our culture from the beginning.
From the outset.
Yeah.
And it's a huge part of how things work, just because, and lest I just, I don't mean to suggest that people are just evil to the core, right? And that the elites are just evil to the core and they're irredeemable. Far from that. Rather, there's a great book I want to recommend, All Politics is Local.
Mm-hmm.
It was written by a history professor of mine in college. He, Christopher Collier. And it's true. All politics is local. All politics happens on the scale of a small group of people. That's how humans are designed to function, is in small groups. We're not designed to function in groups larger than like 300.
Mm-hmm.
Our minds don't really understand it. Our minds don't really appreciate the scale of 300 million people.
Yeah, yeah. More than that.
More than that. We don't, it's not something we can really parse intellectually or emotionally.
No.
We're really, comfortable at our best in a group of about 150.
Well, I think that's why you see the appeal of, you often see, like, if the world was 100 people, these, like,
because it's
charts where they show you, who
what
you,
that looks
how,
like.
How you fit in as far as
it's per very capita. Appealing because you can.
It's very. I find it very humbling and helpful to realize things about the world that way.
Right. You can conceptualize that.
Yep.
Where was I? I was talking about. Size. Oh, politics being local.
Yep.
And how we gravitate to small groups. And the elite thinks they're doing a good job for everyone. I'm sure they think that of themselves.
Yeah.
And default to doing good things for themselves.
For themselves and their circle of
and function as a small group. So I'm not trying to disparage them as inherently evil by definition and irredeemable. What I'm trying to say...
You've used language in the past to talk about this kind of thing. All politicians serve their constituencies.
Right.
However they might imagine their constituencies to be.
To be.
Yeah, and this is my core beef with a politician like Clinton, and why I push back on people when people say, oh, everybody talks, you know, everybody gives paid speeches and whatnot, specifically like her cozying up with financiers and Goldman Sachs and all this, is these folks cannot, if I'm your constituent and it's my interest that I want you to represent, there's not a centrist position where you can also be representing Goldman Sachs.
No, that's, they're actually mutually exclusive.
They are mutually exclusive.
Right, right.
Yeah, sorry.
So this idea of populism is threatening to any small group of people who thinks, we know what we're doing and we're managing the situation.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need the mob.
Mobocracy.
We don't need mobocracy.
Mob rule.
Yeah. We don't need like just anarchy in the streets. God help us. Smashing cars and God knows what else. That's scary and overwhelming, and I get that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still on the left.
Yeah. Well, I mean, governing where the people lead doesn't have to mean governing by riot, honestly.
No, it doesn't.
That's why we have representative democracy.
That's representative democracy, which I personally am not a huge fan of.
Yeah.
As an anarchist, but you know, but that's why we have these other things that aren't just mob rule
and local politics
and local politics.
Yeah, right. But you know, it's. I had a thought. Sorry, keep going. I keep dragging you away from your points.
It's okay. I can kind of come back to my point. I have notes. So next, people are always having a little situation when they talk about communism, socialism, and capitalism.
Yeah,
they always have a situation where the thing that I see happen the most is people conflate communism and socialism as the same thing.
Yep.
Your first clue is that they are not the same word. Okay, that one is communism, and the other is socialism, and then there's capitalism, and there are clues about what they mean in the word. So, capitalism, well, all of them. Let's start from the sort of why they are. Like held together, what holds them together.
Mm-hmm.
They're all about who owns the means of production. It's simple, okay? It's very simple. We're talking about who owns the means of production. These are economic systems. So in capitalism, capital owns the means of production. Whoever has the capital owns the means of production.
Yep.
Right? So it's privately held by individuals, right?
Or corporations, but now.
Well, corporations, that's why corporations are people.
Are corporate individuals.
So they're corporate individuals, individuals,
yeah,
et cetera. But they're privately held.
Uh-huh.
Right? And privately benefited from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Socialism, I think it's fair to think of as sort of on a continuum between capitalism and communism. Okay. I think it's fair to say that. There are folks who would disagree with me.
Okay.
But socialism, the idea is that the government owns the means of production on behalf of the populace. So like the government owns an industry like coal or something.
And there's a long tradition of that in American politics. Even when it comes down to things like state-owned and city-owned utilities.
Yes. A municipal-owned water system.
Yeah.
I mean, so this is not some freakish thing from another planet. It happens. We have it all over the United States. Cleveland has municipally-owned electric.
Yeah, it's the norm for many, many
in
parts
many
of our history and that, communities. Yeah,
that the government itself is the owner of the means of some kind of production. In an industry.
Mm-hmm.
Communism is that the community, not the government, right? The community and the government are different things.
Well, right? Say more about that, because when I hear someone talking about the government, you know, the evil, the government, I'm like, you know, dude, we're the government.
Yeah, technically. That's what we...
So,
I would personally differ from that understanding, at least in the United States, of us being the government.
Okay.
Because we have a lot of restrictions on who gets to participate. A lot of deep, divisive restrictions on who gets to participate. Some of them are no longer legally in place, but I think...
They're de facto in place?
They're de facto in place.
Give me an example. You mean like felons can't vote? Or?
I mean like felons can't vote. Okay. In many, throughout many parts of the country, depending on your state, a felony conviction means you can no longer vote. You can no longer really participate in politics. You're barred from certain jobs.
So in that case, you're no longer a person that's part of the government.
Right.
So, okay.
So you're not there anymore, right? Yeah. Whereas it would seem to me that if the government is us, there wouldn't be any crime you could commit that would essentially erase your status.
Yeah.
Really as a human being, as part of the society.
As part of the society, yeah.
Because if that is true, that the government is us, then we have we literally erase people's status as members of society.
Yeah.
We erase their humanity.
Yeah.
When they acquire a felony conviction.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah. That's a bit extreme.
Yeah.
And I think that's an example. Another example is, so natives live here.
Oh,
and like didn't have voting. I think they weren't allowed to practice their religions until like the late 70s.
Native Americans.
Yeah. So less than 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Like about 40 years ago.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just these things that were not allowed to vote until the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
But they're here, so what's the deal?
Yeah, and locally, of course, there are all kinds of people who are disenfranchised all the time.
All the time, locally, in a variety of ways.
Right.
And it can be like this sort of soft disenfranchisement, where there's no explicit rule saying, you there, wearing the black coat, you can't come in this door.
No, it's between your employment, between your access to transportation and ID, between your access to time off work.
And the polls are open for this six-hour window here, or some absurdity like that.
Too many, you know, there are not enough polling places or not enough voting machines or
et cetera,
whatever, or even gerrymandering, also like a soft restriction, where you're not truly represented in your own community.
So I feel like it's a bit mocking to describe our government
all right.
as us.
Yeah.
When that's the reality.
Yeah. Okay.
So
maybe that's an ideal that we come anywhere close to.
Yeah, that's an ideal we don't come anywhere. And it's a good idea, I guess, but we don't come anywhere close to it. And I, frankly, I'm not aware of a place or time where that happened, that the government actually was us.
I think it only probably has happened in like maybe some utopian communities, and it didn't last.
I do like to bring up the existence of local government throughout New England in the colonial and post-colonial era.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't a lot of towns in New England still have...
Their legislative body is the town.
Yeah, still have town councils.
Not town councils, but they're the town.
Mm-hmm.
All the people that live there that are voting age are the legislative body. They govern by town meeting.
Town meeting, that's what I was trying to think of.
Right. So that all legislation is proposed, passed, and agreed upon at town meeting.
Rather than like a city council
meeting. Rather than a city council meeting, than any kind of legislative body that's separate from the people.
There's not an elected board.
An elected board. All that so the legislative branch of that town is the town.
Interesting. Yeah, I've always been curious about that.
Yeah. Are the individuals who, get this, execute the legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And the judiciary are the people who judge whether or not this is legal based on the legislation the town has passed. Right? And there are some towns in New England, they're very small, that still operate this way, right? And you want to notice there, be very careful to notice, that legislative body is everyone who is allowed to vote.
Hmm.
So there was a time when that was a smaller group of people, much smaller.
Yeah.
And
just landowners.
Just landowners. Yeah. And so there's
white land.
Well, yeah, and in some places, any landowner.
Okay, but de facto largely white landowners.
But yeah, de facto largely white landowners. And, you know, when coupled with laws about who can own land, who's allowed to inherit land, and so on, it excludes a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't mean to hold that up as utopia or ideal.
And that's still not the government is the people, strictly speaking.
Not strictly speaking. So so personally, I don't really embrace that frame about socialism or about government.
Okay.
That government is the people. I mean, sure, I understand that as an ideal.
Okay, but I'm sorry to...
But we were talking about socialism. Because
we're talking about the means of production.
Means of production.
And these three isms.
And socialism is, I'm willing to accept it being on a continuum between capitalism and communism, where the government owns the means of production in certain industries.
And they act as a sort of an intermediary between those two extremes. Right. Yeah.
And I wouldn't even necessarily call them extremes, but there's things. The things, you know. Whereas communism is the means of production is owned by the community. And that implies a certain localism. And I know there are all the people in the world who are going to jump up and freak out about Stalin. And they should, because he was a dictator who murdered people.
Yep.
So I don't misunderstand me and think that I'm trying to say that was cool you know, locally motivated. If it was anything, it was the antithesis of locally motivated, right?
Yeah.
Like all these local places were suppressed and and obliterated by Stalin.
That was communism in name, but it was fascism in execution.
In execution,
yeah.
Right? And I don't mean to play the sort of no true Scotsman game.
Yeah.
That's not where I'm going with this. I'm just defining terms.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just defining terms. I'm not, I don't want you to think I'm trying to play no true Scotsman about communist Soviet Union.
You might need to explain the no true Scotsman fallacy.
Oh, okay. So the no true Scotsman fallacy is this idea that anytime someone says, well, you know, Pepsi is the best soda. And someone's like, well, I had this Pepsi once and it was terrible. And I said, well, then that wasn't really a Pepsi.
It wasn't a real Pepsi. Yeah.
So
the idea is, well, all Scotsmen, you know, are fine, upstanding humans, and be like, well, what about this guy who, you know,
there's a Scotsman wearing his kilt right there,
and he's a horrible falling down drunk that beats his wife, and I was like, well, he's not a true Scotsman,
because no true Scotsman would beat his wife, and so on. That's the no true Scotsman fallacy.
Yeah.
I'm not going there. I do not abide the horrors of communist Soviet Union. Any more than I abide the horrors of the capitalist United States.
Right.
Or the horrors of very socialist regimes that, have done.
It's you can be any of these systems and have a horrifying, oppressive, brutal, murderous regime.
You can do that.
Yes.
But that doesn't change the meaning of these words.
Right.
So communism, the means of production are owned by a community and by people. By people in the, pardon me, not individuals, but by the community. Mm-hmm. And socialism, the means of production are owned by the government. And capitalism, the means of production are owned by individuals with the capital.
He who has the money makes the rules.
Kind of, yeah.
So
that's what those words mean. And if we can just agree to that much, then we can go ahead and talk about other things.
Yeah.
Like what leads to what causes what, and how. And I'm happy to have that conversation. I think it would be rich and lively, but only if we can start on the same page about what these words actually mean.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Similar to like what right wing and left wing actually mean.
Right.
So are you on the side of aristocracy? You're on the side of capital?
Yeah.
You're on the side of the commoners?
Yeah.
You're on the side of labor?
No, when I heard a former boss tell me that he's a right wing conservative, I'm like, so basically, you want to be ruled. You're for the aristocracy, the hereditary aristocracy. You're for wealth, you know, and
preserving everything that is as it is.
And you like Rush Limbaugh, but these things aren't
like connected or the same,
right?
What?
So, I mean, yeah.
Tell me again what you mean. Okay, yeah, I don't know. Right. But and just in that same vein of like the no true Scotsman thing and well then conversations. Sometimes people use these words and they don't mean what you think. Like when you talk about the National Socialist Party of Germany.
Yes, yes. A great example. I was going to bring it up if you didn't mention it.
Right. So. And people say, well, there you go, some right-wing socialists, you know.
Or whatever.
They're left-wing.
Recently people said, well, you should understand that Nazis are socialists and therefore socialists are Nazis.
Socialists are Nazis and like, left-wing.
Yeah, like, well, that, you know, the... North Korea's government is called the Democratic Republic.
North Korean the North Korean democracy.
People's Democratic Republic or something.
North Korea.
Yeah. And,
right?
And that has the word democracy in it and people's, but, you know, it's a dictatorship.
It's a dictatorship. Is it a democracy? Yeah. The people just because they call themselves that?
Right.
Yeah, not necessarily.
So, you know, the operative word, the real important defining part of Nazi, of National Socialist, was nationalism. That's right. That's the aspect of their party and their philosophy that became hypertrophied and, you know,
right.
blew
but
up.
I do feel like there is a clue to the history of what happened there
sure.
in the word socialist. And
sure.
there's a clue to the history of North Korea in the word democratic.
Sure, yeah.
The presence of those words is talking about something that some ideals that people were moved by.
That went horribly wrong.
So, and I think we get this lesson that things do go horribly wrong. And again, I want to bring this home for everyone listening.
Mm-hmm.
Based on the scale.
Hmm.
So okay. when we yeah. all these things are nationwide things that go horribly awry when we try to administer this socialist democracy, whatever it is, on a nationalized scale.
Hmm.
Okay?
Because it's a national scale, the mistakes are multiplied.
They're multiplied, and the decisions
can affect everyone.
Can actually only be in the hand of a small group, functionally.
And they also have the military.
And they have the power of the military to execute them.
Yeah.
The idea is not necessarily the people, but yes.
Yeah.
So we can get confused about that. Now, I also want to define, for the record, fascism. I spoke briefly of it last week, and I'm just going to use the same definition again because I think it's the one that counts.
Mussolini's definition.
The marriage of corporation and state.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think in that respect, I don't think it's inappropriate to think of capitalism as a half step away from fascism itself.
No.
It is not. Because when all the
money... Capitalism has the state on its side.
Has the state on its side to protect yeah. the interests of capital.
Of capital.
Of capital.
Right.
Right? So it's literally one step away.
Yeah. So from, instead of Obama ordering you assassinated, you know, maybe
Blackwater
Musk,
does.
Elon Musk can order you assassinated.
Right.
Or, you know, informally.
Just informally. You know, he puts a word in the right ear.
Yeah.
That those
yeah.
things are not far from each other.
Right.
And I think it's very easy for people who live in a capitalist society and are comfortable in it
mm-hmm.
to dismiss that reality and suggest that it's only over there in socialism, and it's only over there in communism where these atrocities take place.
People who are living well under capitalism and doing well tend to believe that it's right for everyone because it's
yeah.
been good to them.
Right.
And so they don't, you know, you could say they're not woke or whatnot, but...
grab it any way you'd like, right?
Any way you'd like, but it is a very small step from, well, this is going well for me, so the government should exist to defend
the
things that have gone well for me so they
right.
can continue to go
well
for
me
and my family and...
And know, people like me.
My investors, my...
And I think, to go back to my favorite subject, the only antidote to that is solidarity, is to be firmly committed to solidarity with whomever you understand to be the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's a bit of an aside, but that...
And you have to look outside your circle.
Your circle to do that.
Yeah.
To be in deep solidarity like that. So yeah, you need to understand that fascism is the marriage of corporations and the state, which is another reason I can't really think of the government as us.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
I suppose that makes sense.
Because it ends up being this cadre of individuals who then make decisions with corporations, and they just get together around a table and make the decisions that, you know, keep things moving.
And under the modern sort of Citizens United world.
Yeah.
Where you know unlimited money is unlimited speech,
right?
Then that basically enshrined into law.
Into law that capital is the one who gets to
yeah.
make the decisions.
Yeah.
Period. And you know,
gets the loudest voice.
Gets the loudest voice, and your humanity is another issue. It's a side issue, really. And this might be a good point to bring up the Overton window because right now we're kind of outside it.
Yeah.
And I understand that we're outside the Overton window, so I'll just describe what that is.
Yep.
It is the range of ideas the public will accept. There are things that are okay to talk about on CNN. And there are things that are like, whoa, that's ridiculous. And usually it's poo-pooed and brushed aside with by calling it like tinfoil hat conspiracy or whatever.
Or communist.
Or communist, you know, commie pinko ideas and so on.
There's whenever you get to the edge, there's some form of baiting that goes on. Red baiting or, you know.
Or science denier baiting or whatever.
Or you're a fascist.
You're fascist.
Or whatever it is.
So as soon as you start to get to the edge of the range of acceptable public debate, you're getting to the edge of the Overton window. And you, mainstream media does not leave it.
No, mainstream media likes both kinds of music, country and Western.
Exactly. But the thing I think is also important to understand is that we get some fairly active manipulation of what the Overton window is. The elite gets to decide where that window is and what you can see through it.
Yeah. That's Hillary Clinton's book. That's her rage and raging, what she's raging at and about. Sorry.
Raging at and about? What? Tell me what.
Oh, I don't want to turn this entirely into, I've got a lot to say about Clinton and her tour and her, all the stuff she's talking about.
Right.
But just as an aside, to me, that is her still trying. I got into a fight on Facebook, you know, as one does. Where someone's saying, you know, okay, you all can shut up now. She lost the election. You know, we still love her. We're not going to stop loving her. You don't need to criticize her anymore. I'm like, you know what? She's still out there trying to define the terms. She's published this book. She's trying to be the loser writing the history. And I just wanted to add to that. She's trying to, again, define the future of the Democratic Party. Define the definition of Democrat, right?
Right.
And also set the boundaries of the Overton window.
Right.
And a lot of her book is, a lot of it's just like entitled whining.
Right.
But that this is part of what the function of her book, besides, you know, a book contract and making a lot of money, is to try and set that.
Set the terms of the conversation.
Yeah. And what she actually says at one point, this is, you know, I've always felt some words to the effect of, I always felt the best place to be was to stake out a position somewhere between the center left and the center right. And that's like the quote, true center of politics. And I don't know, this is not on your list and you've probably got more terms to define. But to me, the idea that there's a true center, that's a triangulated point between some of these things, between being left wing and right wing,
doesn't actually make any sense.
It doesn't make sense, and it's not popular, and it's not ethically, like, trying to pick a position is, you can't be ethically consistent, you can't be intellectually consistent, you can't, all these things, you're just in a muddle, honestly.
Right. Well, let's just go back to where we are, the origin of the term left and right wing, and think about that for a second in context.
Yeah.
If you're going to be true center between left and right, so first of all, you're just in the aisle.
Yeah.
You're not even sitting down. You're just in the aisle. So, like, we're talking about where you sit in the room.
Right.
So you're just going to stand there.
You're in the way.
You're in the way.
People
you're
can't get in and out.
You're impeding traffic. So not to push the metaphor too far.
We'll put, like, beat it until it's...
Until it dies miserably.
Lump of smoking tar on the ground. Anyways.
But... if we're going to say, okay, let's just balance the needs of the commoners and the aristocracy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the aristocracy has needs and the commoners have needs. And let's just make them, you know, let's balance them.
Weigh them in the balance.
Weigh them in the balance.
Find the place where they balance each other.
Now, personally, that kind of doesn't even make sense to me.
It doesn't make sense at all to me.
It doesn't even make sense. I mean, that's like saying, well, you know, and don't get me wrong, I have this kind of thing with the British royals. You know, I love the fashion, right? But that's
I like the pageantry.
I like the pageantry.
That's a lot of conservatives, I think, really would like for us to have royals just so they can have that celebrity watching.
The celebrity watching, And that's about as far as I go with celebrity watching, although I'm behind.
Yeah.
But the all that pageantry aside, that's like saying, But let's, we've got this single mother over here who hasn't eaten in a few days, and her children, and let's see who needs, if we can balance her needs against the needs of Kate Middleton, because she has needs too.
Yeah, yeah.
Kate Middleton has needs.
If we give this woman free meals, it won't maximize shareholder value.
Or, you know, maybe Kate Middleton's going to lose out if this woman eats.
Yeah.
And I can't have that conversation with anyone.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't parse.
It doesn't parse. It doesn't make sense. It's not a Christian view. It's not
comprehend it as a rational conversation.
It's not a view consistent with any ethical system that I'm familiar with.
But let's see if we need to balance whether or not this woman eats and has shelter with, you know, Kate Middleton getting what?
Yeah. Now, I mentioned shareholders, which muddles the picture because, like my friends would say, well, you know, I own ExxonMobil stock, right? And so when you're talking about, you know,
you're talking about hurting
climate
me.
Change and hurting ExxonMobil, you're talking about hurting my retirement funds. And like,
and that's kind of, that it's a neat little tidy package the way that works.
Yeah, yeah.
But just to bring this into relief, I think we need to move back to the origins of the words to think about what we're talking about. Are we really trying to say, so should we feed this woman? Because, you know, Kate Middleton has needs too.
Yeah, yeah.
And it might cost us too much. We couldn't keep providing Kate Middleton with all her pageantry and her new shoes and her castle. Because, well, you know, this woman has to, you know,
well,
so really, let's keep this in balance.
You see people really talking like that in the aftermath of, was it the Grenfell Towers?
Right.
Fire? Oh,
sweet, precious Jesus.
Like,
yes.
You know.
Yes. Like, well, I don't know.
They can't afford to live there. You know, after we rebuild, they're going to be expensive condos.
So, you know, we just got to keep this in the balance. And when we're actually talking about the needs of basic human needs to eat and to have shelter on one hand,
right,
and versus maintaining your, I don't know, luxuries?
Well, your real estate investments.
Your real estate investments.
In that case.
And I understand your investments are important to you, whomever you might be, and this is your plan for retirement, and I think you've got to invest in that to turn you away from the opportunity to have your community as a place that embraces you and carries you through your retirement.
Yeah.
So I know that that's probably more than we're getting at here, where we're trying to talk about definitions and trying to stay focused on definitions.
I like to spin out on follow all thoughts to wherever they might go.
But that's what I'm talking about when I say there's an Overton window of what you can talk about on CNN.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say, when we're talking about the root meaning of these words, we're kind of getting outside that window and starting to explore things that aren't.
You know, on CNN, when they say conservative, they're only talking about
these policy
modern Republican policy prescriptions.
That's all they're talking about. Yeah. They're not talking about conserving or preserving anything.
Yeah.
I mean, except, I don't know, maybe, I don't know, racist policy. I don't know. Maybe they're conserving that. I don't know.
Yeah, similarly, when they're talking left or liberal, they're not really talking about socialism. They're not really talking about the left wing. They're not.
No, they're not.
Yeah. And we have a whole conversation earlier where you've observed that modern conservatism is really, in most instances, just
it's liberalism.
Liberalism that's turned mean-spirited.
Mean-spirited, that's it. Yeah. And which brings me to another word I'm trying to define.
Okay.
Neoliberalism.
Neoliberalism.
It's these tenets of...
Neo from the Matrix.
No, not that liberal. Not that Neo.
Oh.
But Neo as in new.
Yes.
And it's I would date it from the Second World War forward, that neoliberalism. Because liberalism or classical liberalism is from the Enlightenment and really the principles that the United States was founded on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so in the American context, there frankly is no conservatism, no conservative party in the American context.
Yeah.
Because they were all Enlightenment thinkers working with liberal values.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah, all the founders were
all the founders were.
Were not conservative.
They were not conservative.
Right.
They beat the conservatives, conservatives, and those that wanted to live got on boats and went back to England.
Yeah, yeah.
In large part, or they went to Canada, or they kept quiet.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
Waiting.
They apparently are still waiting. I've not seen them, except for a brief appearance in the early 20th century. But that's really all I've seen.
Not a lot of Whigs around.
Not a lot of Whigs. Well, you know, they sort of like you see them sometimes, like the No Name Party, but or the the Know Nothings, and in these sort of populist movements, right?
Yeah.
And you see them sort of like take up a space like when Roosevelt went with the Progressive Party. You see this sort of emergence of some of these values again. Mm-hmm. But largely, they don't exist in the United States.
Yep.
It's only liberalism, and then policy prescriptions that we assign to the left, assign to the right, and so on.
The hordes, speaking of
the hordes, they're at the door.
Yeah.
Neoliberalism is basically classical liberalism plus free market economics.
Classical liberalism plus free market economics, to the extent that the free market
is really the decision maker.
Overwhelms. You keep talking for a moment. I'm going to run up and
try and just check on them. Yeah. So that's that liberalism plus free market economics. It basically moves you in this position where the only question you need to ask is, well, is this the free market making the decisions here? Is this the free market that's deciding what's happening? Because really, that's the fairest way to make these decisions, is to leave it to the free market. And you get a lot of absurdities that way. Things start to look kind of weird. And where you have conversations about how maybe safety measures at Grenfell Tower would not have been right, would not have been moral, because maybe that would have cost more and had deadly realities another way. And so you have, and Grenfell Tower, just to clarify, was a was social housing or like public housing in the United Kingdom that had a terrible fire. There were lots of indications that it was not safe, lots of reports that it wasn't safe. And it caught fire, burned, not to the ground, but burned and left many people homeless, killed many people. And it is quite frankly a scandal that the poor should have to live in such conditions. But neoliberalism asked the question, well, I don't know if that was really bad because, you know, the free market made that decision. So I don't know that it needs to be any different. And that's frankly absurd. By my reckoning. And I think there's some really great reading you can do about neoliberalism and what it is. And really, it's something important for us to talk about in our society because it's kind of the political ideology that's guiding what we're doing. And a lot of us don't think about it or recognize it as a guiding force for what we're doing. Couple of other terms I wanted to discuss and broach and get on the table. Monarchy, anarchy, and there are folks who call themselves ANCAPs or capitalist anarchists, and there are folks that call themselves ANCOMs or communists, anarcho-communists or anarcho-syndicalists who are anarchist but embraced communism. And then there is a small group of folks that describe themselves as minarchists, as in, and I think they're very really just libertarians. That's my personal opinion. But their self-description is that they want as little, miniature, a minimum, the minimum amount of government necessary to protect property rights. And I think that's closely aligned with anarcho-capitalists who want enough government to protect property rights so people can practice capitalism freely, with no real limits or prescriptions against, say, what they describe as victimless crimes like prostitution or drug use and so on. But again, getting to the root of these things, anarchy. So archy is a ruler who's in charge, who runs things, who is a hierarchy. Anarchy literally means no ruler. There's no ruler in charge. And it's frequently posited as opposed to monarchy, which is one ruler, a king or a queen that's inherits the position by heredity. And aristocracy, which is the elite or the nobility, have these roles that they inherit over time to be a small group that runs things. Anarchy is really the idea that small groups of people make these decisions for themselves. Small groups of people in a place to which they are connected make these decisions as a community. And these communities are largely groups of extended families. So while liberalism and many other frames understand the smallest unit of society to be an individual, a person, an individual person, or in the case of late stage capitalism slash neoliberalism, a corporate person or any like legally recognized person, I understand the smallest unit of society to be a family, an extended family. And that a community is a small group of extended families that are working together. And those people should be making decisions for themselves about things that affect them. So that's where I'm at. Other people have different things that they ascribe to on this continuum from monarchy of one ruler to another end, the opposite end of that continuum or spectrum of anarchy with no ruler. And there are lots of stops on the way. Aristocracy is closer to monarchy. Minarchy is closer to a sort of a libertarian anarchy, which I think is a contradiction in terms, but, you know, whatever.
I came back. I don't want to interrupt you because it sounds like you're on a roll. But
No. I'm kind of blathering. It may be boring for people to listen to.
No, I don't think so.
But the idea of libertarian anarchy seems like a contradiction in terms to me because it assumes the smallest unit of society is an individual.
Yeah. Minarchy being like a minimalist government?
The minimal amount of government.
Possible.
Possible.
Plausible.
Yeah, possible to protect property functions. Rights. No, the minimal
the
amount.
The only thing you're protecting is property.
Property rights. And frankly, to be very clear, the term is used by people who frequently like to wave Confederate flags and talk about things that are you know, some kind of ethno-nationalism.
Are these like...
tend to embrace the term or embrace the understanding of minarchy.
Like sovereign citizen movement kind of thing?
Yeah, that kind of thing, right? Yeah. Which kind of... I just don't have a teleology of humanity that's that atomistic.
Mm-hmm.
That we're just like these random atoms bouncing around in space, independent of each other.
Yeah.
You know, it seems absurd to me, but that's if you want to have a spectrum, it's closer to the anarchy into the spectrum than the monarchy into the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now here's the thing. I think that representative democracy is an attempt to stake out a center point between those two points of the spectrum.
Interesting. And so has inherent into it the flaws that all sort of centrisms...
That all centrism has.
Tend to have.
Tend to have, right. We want to preserve some monarchy, some single ruler approach, but we want to consider the needs of common person. We want to consider some needs of you know.
So it's really an inherently contradictory
space. Representative democracy. I think so, but yeah, that's me.
That sounds less like, it's not an oxymoron the way that centrism is when I consider something. So like
a total oxymoron, right?
So like, you know, the a centrist position between communism and fascism.
Is fascism.
Yeah. Fascism light or with a smiley face.
The smiley face, bing!
Yeah, there's a smiley face on the boot stomping on a human head. Face forever.
Yeah. See, yeah, it's good that way. That's it. Oh, I wanted to talk just a wee little bit about identity politics. I don't want to get too deep into it.
I have two articles that I have to read, and I didn't finish either of them.
Yeah, and maybe we can do a whole... I think identity politics is big enough
topic
to do a whole thing.
Let's do it.
So, yeah, but I just want to touch
today.
On it. Not today. I just want to touch it briefly.
Yeah.
This concept of identity politics, a lot of people trash it. A lot of people say it's the only thing. It's everything. And I don't think it's actually somewhere in the middle. I think it's something different. So first of all,
orthogonal again.
It's orthogonal to like
often a different tangent.
The conversation that we've been having in the public square. It came from a group of black feminists talking about how your identities intersect, right?
Intersectionality.
Right, you know, and which became a thing in the 90s. This conversation first took place or emerged in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversation is simply this. If there is a society that does not oppress a black, queer, Catholic, that society is not going to oppress anyone. It's not going to oppress black people. It's not going to oppress queers. And it's not going to oppress Catholics or Hindus.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if you have all these multiple identities.
If each identity is standing up for itself and not oppressed.
And if we're working to end oppression.
Of all those identities. Then nobody will be oppressed.
Then nobody's going to be oppressed.
Yeah.
And I think there's this perversion of it, or this perverse understanding that somehow not oppressing someone is oppression of someone else.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Or discussing about how, or like even entertaining how.
The zero-sum game thinking.
Right, zero-sum game thinking. That, you know, there's the only, and really, if you break that open all the way and look closely at what's inside of that.
Yes.
We get to this understanding that no one talks about. This understanding that slavery and that taking land, colonialism, slavery and colonialism,
mm-hmm.
are how people got what they have.
Yes.
People know
sure.
that slavery and colonialism is how they got what they have.
Yeah. It's how our economy, how our nation was built.
Right.
Yeah.
So implicitly, they understand that if you make that right, the people who got something are going to have to give it up.
Yeah.
And that's what you're really getting at.
That leads to reparations.
At least all these things. Truth and reconciliation,
yeah,
all that is part of it. If you look closely at what you're saying, you understand that forced labor, enslavement, and colonialism gave you what you have.
Mm-hmm.
And that now, if you're going to make it right, you're going to have to give back what was taken.
You don't get to just, okay, well, you know what? We're just going to reset, but we're not going to start from zero. We're going to start from where we are today. And from now on, we'll be anti-racist. We'll be fair to everyone. We'll be, we won't oppress anyone from now on.
And that's
where your whole thing about bigotry versus institutional racism comes up.
Because, you can hold on to your bigotry for the rest of your natural life. I've got mine. I'm holding on to it. Don't really care.
Yeah.
I'm concerned about institutional racism and institutional policy that enforces this divide. And so when people talk about identity politics and how, what you're really saying is now you're going to oppress me. No. No one's talking about oppressing you.
The way I see it manifest is in the form of what I would call special pleading about feminism.
Oh, yeah. Good.
In other words, Hillary being a feminist and, losing due to misogyny, that feminist argument is more important than economic policy.
Well, I call that the oppression of lippings.
It's like that aspect, voting for her because of her identity to overturn, to break the glass ceiling, to achieve this, what would have been a historic win for a woman president, is more important than all of the, than actually staking out a leftist position where you really support the most people.
The most vulnerable.
And the most vulnerable. That's more important. And I don't buy it. And so that's why I could not support her.
And here's the thing. Not buying that does not mean that you reject identity politics.
No.
And it does not mean that you reject valuing people of identities different than your own.
Absolutely.
Because
that's
really playing this game I call Oppression Olympics. Or like, who's the most oppressed here? And they get to make the decision because they're the most oppressed. And we don't need to play that game. It's an absurd game.
Yeah. No, it manifests too as like, most of the women who would have voted for Hillary were afraid.
These absurdities.
Because their husbands and boyfriends told them not to. And so they went 60-something% for Trump instead. Like, okay.
All right. Yeah, I mean, like, as you're inside their heads. Okay.
Yeah.
Good. But that oppression Olympics is what I describe as the Dems of the Democratic Party making a very cynical use of identity politics to push their agenda through and forward.
And that's something I really would like to hear you unpack more, is when we if we do a show on identity politics, is not so much that identity politics is wrong or isn't valuable or worthwhile to talk about, but that the cynical use of it is wrong.
It's excellent. It's just absolutely toxic.
Yeah.
And it pushes people in these positions like, well, if you care about fill in the blank, then you'll fill in the blank.
Yeah, and that was weaponized in the 2016 election. People were throwing down at the poor and the vulnerable, like, you owe her, you know, you owe this to her, you know.
Like, a poor person of any stripe owes her anything.
Yeah.
Or anybody anything.
Because of
it's absurd.
But the idea is because of her history, you know, of
because of her mythos.
Well, she's been right on some issues, and she's worked on some issues and whatnot. But that overwhelms or overrules all the people that died because of her decisions. You know,
right.
I can't buy it. Don't buy it.
So that's identity politics. I think it's very cynically misused.
Yeah,
but it's a real thing that I think matters.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's identity politics, and like I said, I think we need to. It deserves its own space to really be unpacked well. Last, I think I'd like to end on a positive note.
Yeah, well, I had to leave there. Actually, our neighbor was knocking at the door.
Oh, so that's why they were okay. Yeah,
that's why they're pounding on the door upstairs.
Fair enough. Okay, so the place where I'd like to end up are, and the reason I think it's positive, you may not think it's positive, but I do. I describe myself as a distributist, as a radical, as a left-wing conservative anarchist. And these are the things that I think are places to go and look for a way to do things differently. So take a few minutes and look up bioregionalism.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Take a few minutes and look up localism.
Mm-hmm.
Take a few minutes, and this one I don't think you've heard of, Paul.
Uh-oh.
Sociocracy?
I have heard of it.
Oh, but for me?
From you, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so that,
but only from you.
Only from me. No one else is talking about it. It's
and maybe a few of your out there friends out there on friends. Facebook.
There's a book called Consenting to a Deeper Democracy, which is a unpacks sociocracy for an English speaking audience. Yeah, take a look, see what you think. Yeah. And distributism, which one of my friends describes as anarcho-communism for Christians, Catholics.
Yeah.
And I just think it's anarcho-communism that isn't hostile to religion. That's all.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't feel excluded from your distributist thinking. And I'm not a Catholic. And right. I go to Mass with the family. I'm sort of a barely practicing Christian, but I grew up a Christian, so I'm sympathetic to the values and goals
of distributism.
Yeah.
Right. So those, I think, are isms and things that are worth pursuing. And those are the directions where I'd like to go. And I don't know, maybe we could do a show just unpacking those four terms. But those are the things that I think are connected and interrelated and create a community that's worth living in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That sounds great.
Yeah, that thinks of its biological region as a whole and responds to it locally and personally. Oh, yeah. Personalism is another good thing to think.
Personalism.
Yeah, yeah. That's a Dorothy Day thing.
That's not, has nothing to do with the cult of personality.
And nothing at all to do with
personality. So it'd be interesting to compare those.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So those are some things to do a few whip stitches on and think about.
If you'd like to do some homework.
Yeah, you can think about those things. Yeah. And these other things, think about them more critically when you hear people refer to, you know, some kind of pinko commie.
Pinko commie, conservative, libtard.
Right. It's like the absurdity of referring to Barack Obama as a socialist.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, just the patent absurdity of that.
Yeah.
You should be able to hear that, the absurdity in it, in the statement.
Mm-hmm.
And, Or the absurdity that 45 is in any way a conservative.
Yes.
Right. You should be able to hear how absurd that is.
Right.
If you know what these words mean.
Right.
So I hope that helps. I hope it's good. I hope it's instructive and valuable. sorry if it's not.
I'm going to have to go back and listen to the part you or things you were saying while I wasn't here. Yeah. No, I'm sure it was good. But I came back and you were onto some new words. I'm like, oh, I missed it. Damn. Missed it. All right. Thank you for listening. Goodbye, everyone.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.